Mother's Day is around the corner, and as the mother of five, I like to have moms on the show at this time of year. Today we have a current resident in internal medicine, future hematologist oncologist, and inventor of the Smile Score, a tool to help patients and healthcare providers simplify and prioritize health in their lives. And yes, she's also mommy to a beautiful little girl. Tune in to learn more. Welcome to the 310th episode of Admissions Strength Talk, Acceptance Podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target schools and are a standout in the applicant pool. The result? You get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in!" And only in, but in at the best program for you. The featured resource for today's podcast is 5 Fatal Flaws to Avoid in Your Med School and Secondary Essays. It's May and prime time for writing and polishing med school personal statements. And in a couple of months, you'll also be facing a flood of secondaries. Download this free guide to avoid the mistakes that contribute to the rejection of many med school applicants, both in their primary and secondary applications. To download, go to accepted.com/310download, where you can get it directly, or find the link in our show notes at accepted.com/310. Our guest today is Dr. Laura Vodder. Dr. Vodder did her undergrad at Notre Dame, majoring in biological sciences and poverty studies. She earned her MPH at the University of Pittsburgh and her MD at the Indiana University School of Medicine, where she is currently a resident in internal medicine. She's also the developer of the Smile Score, which we're going to learn about in just a few minutes. Dr. Vodder, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Hi, Linda. Thanks so much for having me today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me. Now, can you tell us a little bit about your background, how you got interested in medicine, where you grew up, and what you like to do for fun when you're not doing medicine?
Absolutely. All of my family is originally from Minnesota, and we moved to Indiana when I was a child with my dad's job. And when I was just a kid, we planned on moving back to Minnesota, but my mother decided to go to graduate school and then medical school. So she enrolled in medical school when she was 37 years old and I was 9. And we ended up staying in Indiana for that reason. And my family still lives in Indiana. I grew up in a small town in Indiana, and that's kind of my background story.
That's great. And what do you like to do for fun?
I have a nearly 3-year-old daughter, and I'm a medical resident. So there's not as much time for extracurricular activities. But in my spare time, I really love to be outside. I spent a few summers in the Rocky Mountain National Park working there. So I love to hike. I like to hike in our local parks and our local state parks, and I like to travel to national parks when I have the opportunity. And I also love to read. That's another thing that really relaxes me, and it's a nice way in all seasons of life that I can relax and rejuvenate.
I'm also, by the way, a big reader, and I like to hike. I mean, I may not go that far, but day hikes mm-hmm. are great.
And beautiful, so relaxing.
And we've been to Rocky Mountain National Park a couple of times, and probably my favorite is Yosemite.
Oh, my goodness. My husband and I, this was a bit ambitious, but we took a 7,000-mile road trip for a honeymoon.
Wow.
And we went all the way up the West Coast and got to see all of the California national parks into all the way up to Washington. So it was beautiful.
You're also mm-hmm. in the Columbia National Park and Mount mm-hmm. Rainier. Those places. We're going to get back to admissions in just a second. Have you been to the Grand Tetons?
I have been to the Tetons. They're just spectacular. It looks like they shouldn't even exist within the United States.
Somebody painted it, right?
It's spectacular. Yeah.
Okay, let's get back. We can go on like this for a long time.
I could.
But let's get back to admissions, because I think that's what our listeners are more interested in.
Absolutely. Sure.
How did you know you wanted to be a doctor?
My mother always says that I knew I wanted to be a doctor before she did, and that I actually convinced her to go into medicine. From a very young age, I was interested in the field. I had a very close friend, actually a coach, when I was a kid that was diagnosed with metastatic cancer when she was very young. And she allowed me to observe her surgeries, go to chemotherapy with her. And I was actually with her when she passed away. And that was such a meaningful experience in my life that I decided I want to be that person that helps someone navigate a very serious illness, to be that person who lets them know they're not alone in that. That was such a meaningful experience that it has shaped the rest of my life and my decision to pursue medicine.
I also want to just point out to listeners that that your comment is very different from I want to help people. You know, you had a very specific niche that you wanted to help, and you knew it, and you could relate it to a personal experience. And it really is, it's very different from the rather generic I want to help people that is so often the answer given to why do you want to go into medicine? And it's that the I want to help people is necessary but insufficient for choosing medicine.
Absolutely. The I like science, I want to help people are very, very important things. If you really like those two things, medicine will likely be a very good fit for you. But being able to relate it to a personal experience and dive deeper into really why you want to go through this rigorous path is very important.
Absolutely. I sometimes tell people, you know, who respond when, why do you want to go into medicine? I want to help people. I say, you know, when my toilet gets stopped up, the plumber comes over and he's a big help. You can be a plumber. Be a lot less time.
And important service, right.
And important service, absolutely. And then we generally do dig deeper. But what was the hardest part of the med school application process for you?
Mm-hmm. So I went to Notre Dame for my undergraduate degree and pursued a science degree. I had a great experience at Notre Dame. And I had a lot of exposure to global health and public health when I was there. And so I wanted to pursue that first before I went into medicine. And so I took 3 years between undergraduate and medical school. So when I came to apply for medical school, I was taking the MCAT a few years after I had taken all of these rigorous science courses. And so looking back, I wish that I would have taken the MCAT when that information was fresh, and then it would have made my application process easier. So during my graduate program in public health, I was studying organic chemistry and physics again, and these things that I knew so well a few years ago, but that those details can sometimes elude us if it's been a few years. And so the relearning the rigorous science information and then having that responsibility to do so and to perform well on the MCAT while I was in my graduate program, that made the process a little bit more challenging for me.
Right. And you chose to do a gap year. Did you know, well, you said you knew all along you wanted to go into medicine, that you wanted to become a doctor. So why did you choose to do a gap year and then the MPH and then go to medical school? Mm-hmm.
There are a few reasons that I did so. Probably the most important reason was that I watched my mother go through medical school and residency training. She never hid the challenges of medicines or the rigors of medical training from me. She was always very open about it. And
how old were you at the time that she, let's say, started medical school or finished with, you know?
So she went to medical school at age 37 and I was 9. And she finished her internal medicine residency when I was 16. Starting my junior year in high school is when she started practicing medicine.
Got it. Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. But.
No, absolutely. So I had grown up rounding with her. She even took me to the cadaver lab when I was a kid. So I was I had this experience as a kid that was very different. And it just facilitated my interest even more in medicine. So all along, I really knew it was the right field for me. But I knew how challenging it would be. And my friends that had gone straight through had always said to me, there's no harm in taking some time to pursue your other interests. So I was very interested in global health and public health throughout my undergraduate program. And so during my senior year, I decided to spend a year teaching in Haiti. And Notre Dame does this really interesting thing when you're for their seniors. They have a career fair, and then they also have a service fair. So they really encourage their graduates to pursue service and see it that and they value it just as highly. And so I went to the service fair, and this was the time when Haiti had just had this large earthquake back in 2010. And there was all of this need for support. There was a cholera outbreak in Haiti, and I did not have any clinical skills at the time. I just had a biology degree, but there was a school in Haiti, Louverture Cleary, run by the Haitian Project, that said, we need teachers and we need help with our community health programs in our community. And so it felt like a wonderful fit for me with my interest in global health and public health as well, and sounded like such a wonderful opportunity to pursue something very different and to have a lasting impact in the lives of other people.
So that was the gap year, and then you did the MPH. Did you know all along you were going to do an MPH? Why did you want, was that a result of your experience in Haiti? How did that fit into your ambition? Mm-hmm.
My advisor in college was a public health expert. So he had an MPH and then a PhD in public health. And he, from the very beginning, had introduced me to public health concepts that I really had not been exposed to elsewhere within science. And it was very interesting to me to think about prevention and public health rather than, I'm sure you've heard of this model, but in medicine, we often, in public health, refer to this model where people are falling into the river and the hospital or the ICU, this is people that are downstream and we're pulling people out of the river, but who is walking upstream to understand why people are falling in the river in the first place? And so that's really what public health and preventive medicine do, is they look upstream and they look at the socioeconomic determinants of health. They look at ways that we can make our population healthier and therefore happier by behavior change, by social justice initiatives. And that was so interesting to me. And I wanted that experience before going into medical school to frame the rest of my training. And I'm very grateful that I did that.
That would give you the opportunity really to frame your curative education, because fundamentally doctors are involved once people get sick, with a frame of reference around prevention, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. It gave me such a different perspective from my peers that had gone straight through. They are wonderful doctors. They haven't necessarily had the training in public health and prevention to understand how to have community health interventions, how to have policy interventions that can have a huge impact on health beyond what we can do at the bedside.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what did you like best about your medical school experience at Indiana University School of Medicine?
I had a wonderful experience. What's that?
You must have liked something. You stayed.
Absolutely. So Indiana University School of Medicine has this model where they have 9 regional campuses across the state. I had a very small medical school class at the Notre Dame campus for my first 2 years, and my husband was doing his MBA at Notre Dame at the time. So it was a wonderful fit. It was fantastic to be back on Notre Dame's campus as a graduate. And at the School of Medicine, I was at the regional campus in South Bend. I had all of the Notre Dame professors, some of whom had taught me in undergrad, and I had very personalized help with studying and all of the resources, including research resources from the University of Notre Dame. And then when I transitioned to Indianapolis for my second 2 years of medical school, I had the opportunity to be integrated into this academic medical center and to understand the hierarchy of having staff physicians, residents, interns, and medical students, and really understanding what that looked like. And that has helped me so much as a resident now. And I had a wonderful experience as a medical student. I felt so supported and empowered, and that teaching was very much valued and emphasized.
That's wonderful. So just to summarize, you liked the fact that you were on 2 different campuses. You felt that gave you opportunities?
It did. It gave me a small class size, which gave me more personalized attention from my instructors. And then my second 2 years, it allowed me to have that academic medicine experience.
Great. And what would you have liked to see improved?
They have actually changed the curriculum in the most recent years in response to this. But when I was a first and second year student, we took an exam every 3 days. We did not have a weekend off until Christmas break. And that was very challenging for our mental and physical health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine. So you would have liked to see a little bit less focus on exams at that point, or just an occasional day off?
A better balance of ensuring that students have enough time to connect with their loved ones and to take care of their health, in addition to supporting their learning.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. Was there ever a time, you obviously were extraordinarily well informed of what medical school was like, and you tested your commitment in multiple arenas. Was there ever a time, either in medical school or now as a resident, when you really wondered if you'd made a mistake and thought about leaving medicine, clinical practice?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I was talking to my colleagues about this. I just finished a 28-hour call last night. I'm post-call today. And we were talking about this last night.
You're awake.
Thank you. I was able to rest today. There have been times throughout residency when I've had a viral infection and I've been on a 28-hour call, and you are lying down in the call room and you get some repeated pages around 3 a.m. So there's never, some nights there's not any moment for any rest. And it's on those occasions when I feel I have been pushing myself very hard. I'm very exhausted and I'm sick. If you put all those things together, there have been some moments where I have asked myself, did I make the right choice? Is all of this worth it to be away from my child and my husband and to possibly be sacrificing some of my future health? I sometimes have wondered if that's worth it. And my colleagues agree with that. And we have found strategies to rest. And that's part of the reason, I know we'll get into that, I've created the SMILE score. But having a strategy when you feel that way is extremely important. A way to refocus your thinking and to be able to make healthy choices in a rational way, so that you can feel better. So that has never been a lasting sentiment. It's always been, and it's been very rare throughout residency. I've had more than probably 30 28-hour calls at this point, and it's only happened a few times. Almost always happens when I'm also fighting a viral infection. But it does happen on occasion.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I always like to ask this question, not to be negative, but so that medical students and pre-meds will know that these sentiments are normal. And then I would hazard a guess, I don't always ask the question of other professions, but that they occur in other professions, right? Not every day as an admissions consultant is delightful.
Exactly.
But I think probably the highs and lows in medicine and the demands in medicine are more acute, So I would think that that's why I probably tend to ask this question most of pre-meds and medical residents and young professionals in medicine. But that makes sense to me. If you're tired and sick, you're not going to be very happy.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing is that the research supports that. There are known factors that influence our health, and if they're missing in our lives, it is completely understandable why we would feel, why our mood would be lower, why we would not feel well. And there is a large impetus within the field of medicine, especially among young professionals and trainees, to make changes for our future students and trainees, to make the work hours more humane and to try to decrease some of these demands on their time that preclude them to be able to take care of their health.
Right. I know, especially some of the newer medical schools and the newer curricula in medical school are addressing wellness as a topic. I mean, they're addressing the issue head on, with a definite commitment to addressing it, to ensuring the wellness of medical students. And this leads right and directly to the SMILE score. So how did you develop the SMILE score, and what is the SMILE score?
In medical training, I was taught to use memory devices to learn important information. If you're studying for our first board exam, which is called Step 1, the amount of mnemonics that you're taught to remember very specific things about bacteria and other pathophysiological processes is almost laughable. But we have no memory tool to help us prioritize our health. And that was very striking to me. Throughout my training, I have known what behaviors are going to make me healthy, but I have at times been inconsistent, and especially when I'm post-call and very tired. It has been in the past hard for me to recall what are the things I need to do to make myself feel better. So in response to those things, being a mother, being a medical resident with a lot of demands on my time, I created a very simple tool to support my health, and I named it the Smile Score. It's a daily self-assessment. It takes less than a minute, and I do this every day to assess how I'm doing prioritizing my health. So the S stands for sleep enough. This usually means trying to sleep at least 7 to 8 hours a night, taking naps on a post-call day, and really prioritizing sleep as an important component of health. And for memory as well. The M stands for movement. So I ask myself, was I active today? This doesn't necessarily mean I have to go to the gym and exercise, but did I spend, you know, a 15-minute block running the stairs on call, or trying to be active through walking the halls, or finding some way to integrate movement into my daily life? The I stands for inhale and exhale. So this to me is, did I take at least a few moments to do some deep breathing, or even better, take some moments to meditate, to be mindful, or to find another healthy way to de-stress, such as going for a walk outside or reflecting on good literature. The L stands for love and connect. It's really interesting that social isolation is just as bad for our health as smoking or having high blood pressure. And in medical training, we often isolate ourselves because we think we need to focus only on our studies, but that's actually very poor for our health. So I ask myself each day, did I meaningfully connect with another human being? Sometimes that's a patient or a colleague or my family, but that's a way to remind me that connection is a very important part of my health. And then the E stands for eat to nourish my body. Did I choose the donut that was left on the table post-call, or did I go downstairs and actually provide myself a meal that can nourish my body? And so every day, it's a score from 0 to 5. I'm very gentle with myself. I know that I'm not going to be perfect. And sometimes a post-call day, it could be a 0 or a 1. And often when my score is low, my mood is and energy levels are also lower. So the Smile Score provides me an objective measure, a tangible way to assess if I'm taking care of my health, and then to take steps to make healthier choices.
Is there interest in the Smile? So have you trademarked it or service marked? I guess it is automatically service marked. Have you registered it? Is there interest in it from medical schools, either starting with Indiana or other programs? It sounds like an incredibly easy tool, you know?
So I spoke with our wellness curriculum advisor at our medical school, and he was just blown away by this idea. And so he recommended I trademark this idea and copyright this idea. So I have done both of those things. We are integrating this into our wellness curriculum at Indiana University School of Medicine within the internal medicine residency. And it's been very fascinating that there has been interest in the Smile Score from many, many others that I did not anticipate. So out in California, there are physicians that have included this within a health curriculum for youth. There have been some physicians that are teaching this in their clinics for their patients as a way to live a healthier lifestyle. And then other residents across the country and young physicians have, and medical students as well have started to use this and have said, this has really helped me. It's a simple tool. It's not rocket science. It's very simple, and therein lies its benefit, is that we can do this daily as a self-reflection to make steps to be a little healthier each day.
I'm thinking of, we unfortunately have an elderly relative right now who was doing fine for a while and then just started to decline. Mm-hmm. And, I was thinking as going through the, he did not eat well. He did not exercise. And the last few months, he was cutting himself off from other people. Not his family. He definitely very much appreciated and liked being with his family members, as long as there weren't too many of them all at once. Especially the younger members sometimes got a little bit hard for him. But, and I think his health has taken a turn for the worse. But before this last change in his condition, he was diagnosed as being depressed. And it I'm just kind of running through the list, the smile list, as you were talking, and for weeks, months, maybe he kind of wasn't doing it. Mm-hmm. Maybe years for some of those categories.
Yeah. And that's absolutely true for some of my patients as well, that there's a lot of emphasis in our country on once you're sick, then we'll treat the disease you have. And we have incredible treatments to treat chronic diseases. But if you look into the data, if you look into the research on what makes people live longer lives and happy lives, it really gets down to those five key things, those five key behaviors.
Is there interest in using the SMILES score for the population, the general population?
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely an interest of mine, given my interest in public health and prevention. So as a clinician, I plan to use this with my patients as a way to counsel them and as a tool. And I think it would be wonderful if this were available to patients, to the population in general, as a very simple way to prioritize health and advocate for their own health in their work and their home environments.
If you're planning to deal with patients suffering from cancer as an oncologist, again, they can be very isolated if they're if they are on isolation, if they're immune impaired, they may not have the energy to move around. The score would definitely apply in that situation too. In other words, keep them moving, keep them somehow connected with people, maybe virtually. If they can't interact in person because they are immune impaired. Mm-hmm. And there are all kinds of applications of the situation with a SMILES score, I think, could be tremendously helpful. Obviously, that's your job. MD, but just common sense, it seemed like a remarkable tool.
Well, thank you, Linda. I really appreciate that. That is my vision for this as well, to empower my patients and to remind them that their health matters and the choices they make every day still matter for their health.
Yeah. Now, we've discussed your education, your full-time work, your part-time work, more than full-time work. What about your family? When the show airs, it will be just a few days before Mother's Day. You have a beautiful family. How do you fit it all in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my husband and I have been married for 6 years now, and my daughter is nearly three. I have the most supportive husband, and I tell this to all of my friends who are single. Find a partner who is an advocate for you and who really supports you. And that has been a huge factor in my success, is that my husband believes more in my success than his own. And because of him, he works full time, but he's able to work from home and has a very flexible work schedule with his MBA. He does data analytics. He takes care of our daughter. He drops her off at daycare. He picks her up. He takes care of most of her needs. And because of his support and the way that he empowers me in my career, it allows me to be fully present when I am home. And I think that is the most important thing, is that there are days that I, like last night being on call, there are days when I don't get to see my family as much as I would like, but we have found ways to make it work. We do video, we do FaceTime when I'm on call. When I am on easier months, we spend a lot of time together. We go to the park. I get to play. My daughter's really into Peppa Pig and Olaf from Frozen right now. So right. I feel like all we're doing right now is pretend play at home with her favorite characters. And it's been easier to balance than I thought because I watched my mom do it.
Makes sense. Mm-hmm. Sounds like she set an excellent example too. Mm-hmm. How do you see your career evolving after residency?
I'm in my second year of internal medicine residency, about to start my third and final year. I'm applying for fellowship this summer, just in a few months, and I plan to become an oncologist. I really see my career as a cancer doctor who cares about the complete quality of life and well-being of the patient. So I anticipate my research will be focused on early detection and screening of cancer, given my interest in public health, and also quality of life throughout cancer treatment. I think it's really important that we empower our patients to be healthy from the very beginning of diagnosis all the way, if they have very severe disease, through the end. And that's something I really care deeply about, is how can we make them have the best life possible with what we can do with medicine and with treatments that we have available.
Do you plan to focus on adult oncology or pediatric oncology?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I will be an adult oncologist and will likely specialize in either breast or lung cancer.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Okay. And is there anything you would have liked me to ask you?
Well, a lot of my friends who don't have children or who aren't married yet always ask me this question, so I think it might be of interest to your audience. When is the best time to have a child in medicine and in medical training?
Okay.
So I'm going to share the answer that my long-term mentor, Yael Shanker at University of Pittsburgh, she's been my research mentor for 9 years. I asked her this question back in 2011, when is the best time to have a child in medicine? And she said to me, have a child when you're ready. When you and your partner are ready to have a child, have a child, because there's never a great time in medicine. So for us, we had my daughter during my fourth year of medical school, and I was able to spend 8 months at home with her because of having research months and online electives. So that was a wonderful time. And others say that during fellowship is a good time to have a child. But the best time to have a child in medicine is when you and your partner are really ready.
I would agree with that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I had six children. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. one passed away from cancer, from leukemia.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Thank you. But I now have five adult children and 15 grandchildren. And
wow, that's wonderful.
Sometimes I hear people talk about how, you know, they want to have a child at, you know, this month or this time of year or this whatever, and I'm quite schedule it. It's not like,
right,
you know, you put it in your calendar, you put it on your phone, or, you know, it just doesn't work that way necessarily. Sometimes you can.
Right.
And of course, once you have the child definitely does not go according to your calendar.
Absolutely not. No. Absolutely not. And I think in medicine, we learn from the very beginning, we learn genetics, we learn that as we get older, the risks of, you know, congenital malformations increase. And so we have men and women who are learning all of these harms that can happen if you delay childbearing for too long, but then they're also thrown into these rigors of medical training. And so it's actually an interesting dichotomy, but I think it's very important for women and men to know their options for fertility and to really to have a child when they're ready and to plan ahead if they're deciding to wait to have a child until later.
Right, I agree. And you obviously have a much more medical basis upon which to agree, but there are certain things you can plan a little bit for, and then the rest you just got to deal with as it happens.
Absolutely.
And even if you can plan when you have the child, that's fine, but once they come, all bets are off.
All bets are off. Oh, all goodness, bets are isn't off. That the truth?
Love whatever you get.
Absolutely.
Anyways, Dr. Vodder, I want to thank you. I think we're just about out of time. I want you to thank you so much for sharing your story and your insight, and particularly teaching us about the SMILES score. I think that's fascinating and a wonderful, wonderful tool. And thank you mostly for being so generous with your time a day after this very long call. Where can listeners find you online and learn more about you and your SMILES score and everything else going on? Mm-hmm.
So I try to be active on social media to empower young providers and to help them understand what it might be like to have a family within medicine. And so I'm on Instagram at Doc Laura Vodder. And I also have a website for the SMILES score, which is thesmilescore.com.
Okay. We'll link to Dr. Laura Vodder's sites as well as other resources related to this podcast from accepted.com/310. Listener, thank you too for joining Dr. Laura Vodder and me for AST's 310th episode. And now a final reminder and a favor. Please remember to download your free copy of 5 Fatal Flaws to Avoid in Your Med School and Secondary Essays. And that way you'll know what to check your essays for and how to avoid these issues in them. And the favor, if you find the show worthwhile, please tell a friend about Admission Straight Talk. They'll thank you, and so do I. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.